Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
It is finally here, election week, and we will be bringing you local perspective, the latest on the results each day. Today, that means checking in on New England races in New Hampshire, Maine, Massachusetts, and all this week we'll bring you analysis and conversation about tomorrow's historic election. I want to start with New Hampshire. We have WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks with us. Hey there, Anthony.
Hi, Tiziana.
So tell us a little about New Hampshire's first congressional district. I know it's unfolding, or it has unfolded pretty interestingly. It's flipped, I think, every time in the last five election cycles. Tell us about that.
Yeah, more or less. I mean, so this covers the eastern end of the state, and it seems like this is a district that really can't make up its mind whether to send a Republican or a Democrat to Washington. So between 2008 and 2016, that's five election cycles in a row. It rocked back and forth. It elected a Democrat to Congress and a Republican, then a Democrat, then a Republican, and then a Democrat. And it's been described, by one veteran lawmaker up in New Hampshire as the swingiest district in the country. And we should say the incumbent is Democrat Chris Pappas. He was elected 2 years ago, and he's trying to become the first incumbent in 12 years to win back-to-back races in this district. And he's running against Matt Maurer, who worked in the Trump State Department, backed by President Trump. And the race really boils down to Maurer argues that Pappas is sort of, you know, wedded to Nancy Pelosi, and that's bad. And Pappas has worked very hard to link Maurer to President Trump. And that may be working for him because Trump isn't polling very well in New Hampshire. He's running 8 or 9, 10 points behind, depending on which poll you're looking at. So it's not a good moment, at least in New Hampshire, to be linked to President Trump right now.
Speaking of the moment in New Hampshire, briefly, what's early voting like there? How much of this is going to come down to tomorrow?
Well, a lot's going to come down. New Hampshire doesn't have early voting. They do have absentee ballots, but there's no in-person early voting. But absentee ballots are way up. I think the last number I saw last week was something like a quarter of all folks have voted through absentee ballots, and that's way up over 2016. But most people will be voting on Election Day tomorrow in New Hampshire.
All right, so that's New Hampshire. Anthony, please sit tight. I'm going to turn to Maine for a few minutes here, because up in Maine, the fate of the entire U.S. Senate could hang in the balance. Democratic Speaker of the House, Maine House, Sarah Gideon, is looking to unseat Republican Senator Susan Collins, the longest-serving woman in the Senate. It has been a pitched battle, slews of money. We've got Maine Public Radio's chief political correspondent, Steve Missler, here catching us up. Welcome, Steve.
Thanks for having me.
So how did this race get this big, Steve, in terms of money, importance, national attention?
Yeah, well, you just touched on it. I mean, the first reason is that it's one of a handful of seats that could determine control of the U.S. Senate next year. But to even get to that point where a race against Susan Collins is even competitive, you have to have a lot of other factors sort of line up to create a bit of a perfect storm, and we definitely have those. The president is unpopular in Maine statewide. So that right away is a drag on Collins because they belong to the same party. But Collins has always outperformed the top of the ticket, including in 2008, which was a huge wave year for Democrats. Collins weathered that with her moderate reputation. What's different this time, though, is President Donald Trump. He's such a polarizing figure that many voters here see the Senate race as a binary choice. You either oppose this president or you support him. And Collins has taken several votes that have called into question whether she's as independent as she's long claimed to be. And there are voters here who really see some of those votes as a betrayal. That's why Democrat Sarah Gideon is hammering home the argument that Collins has changed. She's not who she once was.
And how big is the Brett Kavanaugh vote, her vote in, to support him for the Supreme Court in all of this?
Yeah, that's huge. I mean, you can literally draw a straight line from the Kavanaugh vote to Collins' decline in popularity. I mean, she used to be one of the most popular members of the U.S. Senate, and now she's one of the least popular. And, you know, you could argue that the decline began with her vote for the Republican tax overhaul in 2017, but it was really Kavanaugh that initiated the big slide in favorability, especially among women. And women have long been part of Collins's winning coalition, stretching all the way back to when she was first elected to the Senate in 1996. She also has identified as a pro-choice Republican. But when she voted for Kavanaugh, who was nominated precisely because the president was trying to please his pro-life constituency, a lot of women viewed that as a betrayal here. And it also initiated a massive fundraising operation that drew some $4 million that was directly transferred straight to Sarah Gideon's campaign when she became the Democratic nominee over the summer. And since then, activists and liberal interest groups have spent millions keeping up the pressure. Even before the campaign, there were ads and events designed to keep the Kavanaugh vote top of mind. And I think that's a big part of the reason why Collins has remained in trouble.
All right. So let's dig into the cases the two candidates are making. Let's start with Democrat Sarah Gideon. We haven't talked about her yet. What's her case?
Yeah. So Gideon was a relatively unknown political figure here before the race began. I mean, she's currently the Speaker of the Maine House, but that's not really a position that a ton of people follow that closely. And in some ways, that may have benefited her because her campaign has been able to fill in the blanks, if you will, and position her as a moderate who voters trust to potentially replace Collins, not some hardcore partisan, which I think, generally speaking, Maine voters tend to reject. But her primary argument is that Collins has done the bidding of President Trump. And it's an argument she made a week ago when the president showed up here to campaign on short notice. Here's what she said.
Senator Collins may not want to be seen here today, but make no mistake, over the past 4 years, she has chosen over and over again to stand up for Donald Trump and his priorities ahead of Mainers.
So you can hear there that Gideon made note that Collins did not show up for Trump's visit, and that's part of her campaign, her argument, really, that Collins is hiding her support for the president and not being forthcoming with Maine voters.
So what's Collins' argument?
Well, Collins is making the classic incumbent argument, which is that there's no reason for voters to gamble on Gideon. She's too risky. And Collins has basically been saying, look, you know me, and even if you don't like the way I vote some of the time, you know that I'm trying to do what's right, what's in, you know, what I think is a principled decision. The other case she's trying to make is that she's high in seniority in the Senate and could become chair of the powerful Appropriations Committee. But her primary argument is that she's delivered for Maine and that Gideon won't be a suitable replacement. And here's what she said when I interviewed her in early October about that.
Nor would she have the clout and seniority that I have to bring much needed assistance into our state.
Yeah, the other thing to know here is that Collins is really trying to denationalize the race, you know, to move it away from Trump, which is, you know, problematic for her. And it's probably a smart strategy, but it's not quite clear whether it's a winning one. We just don't know that yet. I mean, she's been haunted by 2016, which is when she declared that Trump was unfit for the presidency. Now she won't say whether she's voting for him or not, and that's only served to bring more attention to the issue. And Democrats here have been needling at that for months, if not longer.
So the other thing I want to ask you, it's relevant to Massachusetts because ranked choice voting is on the ballot. I understand this is a close race. Is it possible that this Senate race could be decided using ranked choice voting?
Absolutely. Yeah, the way the polls are going right now, it's hard to see either of the two candidates breaking getting a clear majority on election night, which, of course, is the only way you can win outright in ranked choice voting when there's more than two candidates. And we do have two independents on the ballot here. So if neither Gideon nor Collins can break that 50+1 on Tuesday, then we could head to a ranked choice runoff, which could take some time. It could take a week potentially to settle the contest.
Is there a conventional wisdom on who is favored in a ranked choice voting scenario?
Yes, there's definitely a conventional wisdom, and it's that Gideon would benefit, and part because there's a an independent in the race, Lisa Savage, who is to the left of Gideon. So, you know, the conventional wisdom is that, you know, hardcore progressive voters are going to, you know, probably vote for Lisa Savage first, and then they'll rank Gideon second, which in which case, if that actually comes to fruition, you know, Lisa Savage's second place votes could potentially put Gideon over the top. I don't know if it's that clear cut or not. We haven't seen enough polling that actually polls a ranked choice election here to suggest whether that conventional wisdom will actually hold true. There's a lot of surprises that we just can't foresee, but that's certainly where people think the race is going.
Well, I think that's going to be fascinating for us to watch from here. Steve Missler, Maine Public Radio's chief political correspondent, we'll say goodbye to you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let's turn back to WBUR's Anthony Brooks. Anthony, let's talk about the presidential election now, and now let's talk about Massachusetts. We've done New Hampshire, we've done Maine. Donald Trump got more than a million votes in the Commonwealth in 2016. What counties are you watching this time, and you know, what are you expecting to see unfold?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, we think of Massachusetts as a very blue state, and of course it is. But as you said, a million folks in the state voted for Trump 4 years ago. Those were some communities along the South Coast. And then there's this interesting line of towns where we did a bunch of reporting basically from the New Hampshire border right down to the Connecticut border, running right down the middle of central Massachusetts. And these tend to be old mill towns. In a lot of ways, they sort of reflect the kind of dynamic that you saw in the upper industrial Midwest and those kinds of communities that supported Donald Trump. A lot of the same issues, manufacturing jobs gone. People feel kind of disconnected from the booming economy within the 128 area. So they voted for Donald Trump. So, yeah, we spent some time out there, did some reporting on that, tried to understand what it was that motivated voters, and went back recently to try to figure out, you know, to what extent people have shifted, have their views shifted 4 years into Donald Trump. And those are some of the communities that I'm going to be watching with interest. Assuming Biden does well tomorrow, it will be interesting to see if these communities move with him or not. Or
so you
if
went to-
Donald Trump is reelected, it'll be interesting to see if these communities remain with the president.
Yeah, I think one thing we can all agree on is it's going to be interesting. You went to Ware last week. Tell us what drew you to Ware and compare and contrast it to 2016.
Well, Ware is one of these towns, you know, right smack in the middle of the state. It's an old mill town, sort of down on its luck, about 10,000 people. Used to have sort of this booming economy around the mills that were there. And it voted for Trump in 2016. So I was interested in just going out and talking to people the other day, and we were also doing a feature on early voting and the high numbers. And so if I'm recalling correctly, 6,900 registered voters in Maine, 4,000 of them had already voted by the end of last week. So that gives you a sense. And it kind of reflects what's going on all across the country. And I spoke to Patty Bono. She voted for Joe Biden because she told me that Trump has failed on several important issues.
I would say his handling of the virus, for one thing, climate, especially science, because global warming is a thing, and it worries me that he doesn't care about it. But I also don't like him. As a woman, I don't like him.
Now, her husband agrees that President Trump has mismanaged the health crisis, but he gives him credit for a strong economy before the pandemic. So Peter Bono voted for Trump and sort of represented this stark disagreement within one family that reflects the disagreement in a divided nation. Here's Peter Bono.
Again, when it comes to the economy, I'm a small business owner, so it worked for me.
And Tiziana, I said, you know, how does that conversation work out at home around the kitchen table? And he said, yeah, we don't talk about it at home. it's not a conversation we choose to have.
All right, let's stay with Ware for a minute.
In the interest of marital, right, yeah.
That's right. And don't we just know that that's happening at kitchen tables all across New England, right? So
yeah.
President Trump, you heard in the, you know, the top of the show when we talked about Galvin's press conference today, President Trump has made a lot of comments about election security, about mail-in voting. In a piece that you did on your visit to Ware, resident Joseph Martel told you that he's concerned about the results of this election. Here he is.
With mail-in voting and all that, it's just out of whack the way it's going. It's going to be fraud, and I wouldn't be a bit surprised if when the election comes along, we have a civil war.
Yeah, so, that was a...
Yeah,
go ahead, DC.
Go for it. No, jump
well,
in and react
that
to that.
That was a really troubling thing to hear, but, you know, that idea is out there, and that voter, Joseph Martel, has obviously been sort of absorbing the messages coming from the president, who's working hard to undermine confidence in the voting system. We should, you know, hasten to point out that... that there have been very, very few cases that have been documented over the years of voter fraud. But this is a narrative that the president has put out. This is a Trump supporter who is clearly parroting some of the concerns that the president has. I'm really concerned when I hear people talking about civil war. I don't believe it's going to come to that. I think Americans are more level-headed than that. But obviously we're all anxious about how this is going to play out in the coming days.
So obviously we can't know, and I'm not going to put you on the spot to prognosticate about what's going to happen tomorrow night in terms of results. But given your experience, what's the sort of time frame that you expect before the United States is certain about who the president is?
Boy, it's a really difficult question, and it really depends which states it comes down to. You know, Florida has already been counting its absentee vote. It's mail-in ballots, I mean. So we might know early in the evening the results in Florida, the same in Arizona. If those two states, for example, show a strong result for Joe Biden, we actually might know something early in the evening. But it's more likely that we're going to be waiting for states like Pennsylvania and Michigan, which will begin the process of counting an enormous number of mail-in ballots, and that could take days. And that's the message that people have to understand. This isn't going to be like a traditional presidential race where we're going to watch TV until 10 or 11 in the evening and know who the president is. We might, but it seems more likely that we will not. And for some people to suggest that who's ever ahead at the end of election day should be declared the winner, that's just completely out of whack and inconsistent with the way these with elections, the way we count votes in this country.